This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 11, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, synchromystic and co-host of the podcast 42 Minutes, Will Morgan, as well as a second one-on-one dialogue with fellow co-host of 42 Minutes and author of Winter's Labyrinth, Douglas Bowles. Both guests this week, who are likely familiar names to many of you listening, provide valuable insights into the world of synchronicity. For those of you less aware, Douglas and Will are two of the founding fathers of the aesthetic intellectual movement best known as synchromysticism. Over the last 6 years, they have also done an amazing job helping to make the SyncBook a respectable platform that fosters offbeat artists and thinkers. While they spend most of their time nowadays asking other creative people about the work they do on 42 Minutes, I thought it was about time they had the spotlight put back on them for a short while. Both of them deserve tremendous credit for the work they do, and it was a pleasure for me, as a longtime fan, to pick their brains about their views on sync, life, and artistic expression. I think you'll notice more than a few interesting intersections between the two dialogues. So, thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. So you just had Tessa Dick on 42 Minutes for the second time, right? Now, I'm forgetting completely. Did she confirm, was Christopher their son?
Yes. She was there. She said that the Valis stuff happened when they were there.
But the reason I asked was just, I think I had heard it confirmed that, you know, when he had the vision, he got the message that Christopher had a hernia and let the doctors know.
Yes. We asked specifically about that in the after conversation, and she said that he made it seem like it was more impending, like this is something they had to deal with, an emergency surgery right away, but it wasn't something they dealt with for like a year or two. He really did have a hernia, but it was something they just had to be careful about for a time until he was old enough to do a surgery.
But he did seem to foresee it.
He did foresee it.
Okay. That's really interesting to me. Out of that entire experience, for me to verify a lot of these things, there's a very fine line between subjective delving into the unconscious can be considered a hallucination or a pathological hallucination. But then there are these other instances of transcendental experience where people bring back veridical or information from the objective world that coincides with their subjective experience. So in those moments,
those are what really catch my attention. Because that really is the indicator that, okay, the mind is not totally in your head, if that's the case. If you're getting information in this sort of way, through a disembodied experience or other sorts of visions or whatever, there's something very telling about the mind. And I'm not sure what it is, what it's telling us, but it's telling us that maybe we don't fully understand what's going on. So someone like Tom Campbell, for instance, who had a lot of experience and documented experience at Monroe Institute going out of body and verifying information, or Stanford Research Institute, which was the CIA government program for over 20 years, having tons of success with remote viewing, pulling back objective information, verifiable. Those are things that really make me question my reality, whereas psychedelic experience and these sorts of things are interesting and give insight into our own minds, but I don't know what they really tell us about reality.
Yeah, it seems like Tom Campbell that you recently had on was pretty interesting on that subject. I mean, it was a little harsh on psychedelics, but it seemed interesting that there was kind of a ride you went on with psychedelics, but you couldn't deviate too far from what the substance provided as far as the ride goes. And that what they did at the Monroe Institute was a true exploration of the other world. It's so hard because I don't know what to call the other space anymore. It's like the unconveyable or the undescribable.
Right, because we don't know if it's another dimension. We don't know if it's our universe, only is sort of just a different layer of it. I tend to think the universe is like an onion. There's one universe, but it's a huge onion. All these sorts of layers to it. You could call those different universes if you want, but I usually conceive that there's just one universe. It's just so inconceivably large that through these explorations, if you will, we're just finding one other little corner of it.
Yeah.
But who's to say? If this thing's not telling you that something's going to happen tomorrow and then you verify it, we don't know what's going on there. We don't know if it's total fantasy or it's this or that. And that's the thing with Tom. Like, he's very interesting that he says, don't be dogmatic. Take what I say with a grain of salt. But he's very insistent on his model at the same time, you know, which I respect. That's okay. But at times it shows like a sort of schizophrenia, and it's an interesting insight into psychology where people say one thing, but then they really fall in love with their own ideas.
It's hard to, like, not say something authoritatively and not, you know what I mean? Like, Will and I talk about this every now and again, where when we first started blogging, we would say things with so much certainty, just because you had to, because you're writing it, you're saying it, and then because you're saying it, it seems like that's a thing. All right, this is a thing, this person has a point of view. When in fact, they don't know what they're talking about. They're just trying to figure it out. And it's the same as we have guests on the show. We realize these people who are writing articles in magazines, you know, they don't necessarily – they're not an authority on it. They've just written an article about it. And thus, we give them credibility because it's in a mainstream forum.
Yeah, and I guess in doing my own writing lately, I'm trying to find that balance between, okay, do I – need to come off as an authority? Do I always have to come off as someone that's always questioning myself? How do I find that middle ground? And in studying Robert Anton Wilson, I still don't know how exactly he does it, because he's clearly taking positions, but through reading it, it never sets off those alarm bells of, oh, this person's telling you what to think or what to do. And so I'm just trying to come to that position, right? It's like, you can't not have opinions, but there has to be a way to communicate them in a way that's not as insistent or as aggressive or something like that. And I don't know what the line is.
Yeah, I don't know. I just tend to ask questions. It seems like the people with the answers, they're slightly more dubious. Every question leads to another question. It's kind of what I like, especially with sync. We're never going to arrive at something. It's always just a spinning, pointing and spinning.
And it goes back to Alex Fulton and I just had this discussion about everything is process, that to think that there's a destination to anything is sort of a fallacy. So you could set a goal or you can have an end point in mind, but there's no end. It just keeps going. And so you have to understand that, yeah, you can't be so results oriented. Or for my personal philosophy, I find that more, it preserves my sanity, and that I'm not holding myself to these absolutes, and you have to be able to adjust because life is a chaotic maelstrom at times. And if you're too rigid, it's going to break you that way. And synchronicity, I think, is one of those things that helps you open up to that sort of just general approach to life. So my question to you is, like, when was your first interaction with Sync? How did you start blogging? What drew you to synchromysticism? How did you meet Alan? These sorts of things. A little bit about your background.
Sure. I think, okay, so I moved from Seattle to Boise in 2003. And then I think the first time I heard any type of conspiracy, like 9/11 conspiracy, was on Art Bell. And it was shocking to me when I heard it. I'm like, that is shocking. How dare they? I had listened to Art Bell in the mid-90s. And so I liked paranormal. So X-Files, Twin Peaks, these are fun things. But that's because they're non-threatening, because it's a fiction. So here's this thing apart from reality, because it's just a fun space, fiction. But Art Bell was kind of crossing that line, which was also fun. You know, it's where the fiction bleeds off the page a little bit. So when I came back and I first heard that idea of questioning reality, so to speak, and then a few years later, somehow that seed that was planted definitely took root. And so it must have been 2005, 2006, I started asking questions, because there were a lot of strange coincidences or just synchronicities or just uncanniness. And the first thing that I really found back then was the 911 Synchronicity podcast by Richard Grove. And so at that point in time, I was working at UPS late night, and I listened to lots and lots of stuff, books and podcasts and lots of stuff. And I really did that in a big way, but it definitely took me to like a really dark, negative, paranoid space. And I think later, 2007 or 2008, I found Jake Kotz's videos. And then not long after I found that, I started my own blog. So like, I found his videos, I watched a lot of them, I read his blog, and then I started corresponding with him personally, and he responded back, which was interesting, because like we were saying, the idea of what makes someone an authority, and because he was doing it, it seemed like he was an authority on some level, but it was part of that magic time when the technology was opening up to people to be able to self-publish their work. And if you did it with a little bit of credibility, it seemed like the person, they were bona fide. They're bona fide. They're doing this stuff. And then from there, I think my blog started in the fall of 2008 or so, somewhere in the 2007-2008 range. My first blog took off, and I was definitely exploring my path in the realm of synchronicity. And then not long after that, there was this kind of accretion of like-minded individuals that formed kind of a density where we were all blogging and we were all commenting on each other's blogs. And the next natural step was to form a group blog. And that was the Sinkhole. And so it was like Will Morgan, Jake Kotza, Jim Sanders, Ty, John Kidd, Kevin Halcott, Richard Aerosmith. And then that went on for a while. And then eventually Alan started commenting on the Sinkhole, maybe 2010 or so. So I don't know how he found us. But then that was always the thing, that the problem with the Sinkhole was there was kind of an exclusive feel to it a little bit. And I didn't know how I felt about that. Like, the Wrong Way Wizard was a member of the Sinkhole for a while, but every now and again we'd get a mixture of people that rubbed each other wrong, and there would be kind of like this Lord of the Flies type moment when <'cause> everyone was an admin in that group, and anyone could do anything, and so sometimes someone was all of a sudden booted off. And so Mark LeClaire, I mean, so there was some really interesting interactions with Mark LeClaire. I don't know. It took the right kind of person to collaborate in that group. And so in the end, I don't know that I was the right kind of person either. So at some point, I quit that and then wanted to try the same kind of idea, a collaborative sync blog, but I wanted to open it up to some of the people that weren't part of the sinkhole. And those were people like Michael Schott, Alan, Crystal Kanar, Jason Brera, you know, what became the Mask of God, Sybil Hunter. There were these other people that were commenting on the sinkhole. There wasn't any structure or hierarchy or rules in the sinkhole, but then it seemed like at some point there were these organic rules that formed where, you know, it's like, who gives who the right to add people? Because, you know, we had problems early. Someone would add someone and then there would be some kind of explosion. But I mean, I went to Winnipeg. The first quote unquote sink cabin was me and Kevin Halcott going to Winnipeg in 2010, the year we made contact. We did a ceremony and we toured their legislative building and everything. So all the mystique that they blogged those early years in 2009, you know, it's like, this is interesting. So the idea of the fiction bleeding into reality, like I was saying. Anyway, the transition from conspiracy to synchronicity was natural for me because conspiracy becomes ridiculous at some point. To my logical mind, the conspiracy becomes so grand that it's either the grand conspirators definitely have all the power and it's more like God, the author, so that it's more like some kind of system that we're in, or it's us that we're doing it to ourselves. We're making the Dallas loop occur.
The villain are us.
Yeah, we're the bad guys.
And that's something I struggle with too. Obviously there's a power structure in place. Power structure has certain effects on our lives. Sometimes they're pretty draconian boundaries as to what we can, can't do, these sorts of things. At the same time, like you said, it seems like it stresses credulity at some point where if you study this enough, I mean, it just doesn't seem like it could be quite all powerful. And they do things behind closed doors, but it doesn't necessarily mean they know what they're doing. They're as scared and as pathetic as, you know.
I don't know. It's a loaded moment. And anymore, I don't even know what to do with it. Because it seems like it's dubious to go down that rabbit hole because it will make you crazy. Because it seems like logic breaks down on some level.
I like Alan's position. He's like, I want people out there being detectives, and I want people out there looking for actual criminal behavior and criminality and whatnot. But then conspiracy theory goes off the rails because then it does start focusing on these mega rituals, things that are totally outside the realm of evidence. He complains that people took his video in conspiracy circles and turned it into proof that they did it. And he's saying, well, this isn't evidence for anything beyond the fact that it's this highly synchronous event. And at the same time, that's never going to hold up in the court of law. And I think the heart of conspiracy theory should be to identify, can we identify that Cheney planted the C4 or something like that? I mean, that should be really the heart of civilian journalism. And I think conspiracy theorists, if they're walking this or bleeding through into this weird stuff, it's like they're accomplishing nothing. They're just creating a lot of noise. So what's the goal of the conspiracy theory?
It seems like there's something empowering about the narrative itself. By saying, I know the truth, it empowers the unempowered individual on some level. To make sense of reality, we need a story. That's why, like, we're the storytelling animal. We always are gravitated to some kind of story to make sense of the universe. And conspiracy is a story. We had one guest in 42 Minutes that said, it's a genre. Conspiracy is a genre. And I thought that was interesting. It's an interesting way to think about it because on some level that is true, that some of these fictions that are paranormal and appealing do kind of start out in that realm where it's more of a guilty pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So after I traveled to Winnipeg and after I started The Mask of God with a bunch of other people that weren't necessarily in the collaborative space, then, you know, Alan, I think both asked Kevin Halcott and later me, you know, what would it be like to have an anthology of essays? You know, everyone's writing essays. And so really, Alan, I mean, that was his baby, the sink book. And not only was his baby, but he had to actually give birth to it. So I knew a lot of the different people and I helped coordinate as far as coordinating a group of people is like herding cats. I mean, you've seen this. Trying to get anyone to show up on time for an always record. And so I was always pretty good at sending emails and stuff. And that, you know, as far as like, what should we call this? Who should we invite into it? That kind of stuff. But then as far as the actual nuts and bolts of editing it. And at that time, Justin Morgan, he was another Mask of God person. He had found Alan. I don't know how he found him, but there was like this really incredible resonance. And then, you know, he signed on to do all the art and it just worked out. And then Alan happened to have this wedding he was going to on the West Coast in the summer of 2011. I've got a family cabin out there. And so he came and then we had this free cabin. And so I said, hey, let's all get together. And then we kind of looked at the proof and met each other. And that was like the first time a lot of us had, you know, we had all these experiences. So Michael was there and Andras was there. Jason Barrera was there and Crystal and Alan and Justin. And so it was really cool to actually share physical space, but it was not like mediated space because it was totally, there was no power. It was cut off from nature or cut off from the world. So like, that's so funny too. I was thinking about this the other day. So basically I rented a car. I picked up Jason because he lives a few blocks from me. And then we drove to Portland and met Justin Allen and Steve Wilner. And then I picked up Alan. And then we drove to Seattle to get Crystal to go to the cabin. But the first time I met Alan was on that ride, and the traffic was horrible. And then he and I were just having one of these like Monty Python conversations about you can't base a system of government on some watery tart distributing swords, except it was the idea of beavers and dams and man and what is natural. And he's talking about the city and I'm talking about nature. And it was just this super intense, incredible conversation that would be great in a movie. And then at the sink cabin, that's when both Andras and I had this ulterior motive where we both had these books that we were working on. And we just saw, you know, the benefit of having a platform to say, all right, well, if we have a little bit of momentum, what if we have, you know, like add to that momentum by saying, hey, this is a thing and our book is coming out on this thing. And then everything was just the next logical step. And so Sync Book comes out, great. And then Accidental Initiations and Winter's Labyrinth come out, great. And then, you know, after the Sync Book's out, we need a way to sell it. And so that's when Will and I kind of come together and do 42 minutes. Like, all right, we need to sell sync books. Let's talk to everyone in the sync book and see what they wrote. You know, that kind of thing.
So why don't we talk about your book real quick called Winter's Labyrinth. And I really loved your contribution to Sync Book 1 because it was one of the few fictional pieces in there. It had obviously a mythological aspect to it. And so what inspired Winter's Labyrinth? What inspired that chapter? What drew you to that type of storyline?
It's me finding balance. So that's the thing. Like I was saying, as people are blogging, they're saying things they're trying to figure out. But at the same time, they're saying things like they're certain of what they're saying. And I'm like the guy that puts on the shirt and says, okay, this is an interesting shirt. I'll try it on and see how it fits. But then if you're part of a group system and it seems like the group system's arriving at some kind of statement, you know, theology or dogma at worst – it's hard. It's like, well, I don't know if I agree with this. And so Winter's Labyrinth was my way of coming to terms with my own idea of what it is to be alive.
So do you take some of that literally? Do you get the sensation that there is this sort of reincarnation aspect or past life aspect to existence?
Maybe. I don't know. Yes. I think down deep, it's not something that I spend a lot of time with. But it definitely makes a lot of sense. So one of the things that we do with reincarnation is think of it linearly. So like time is linear. Here I am. I'm Doug right now and then I die. Or let's say, okay, I'm Jimi Hendrix and then I die and now I'm Doug, right? That would be like a linear reincarnation.
Yeah.
Okay. But what if time doesn't really work that way? What if all these versions of ourselves are happening simultaneously, that we bump into ourselves over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a thought that I have, that like a fractal, there's different versions of ourselves happening. And sometimes we're fascinated by ourselves, like the people that really capture our imagination are the ones that are reflecting more of ourselves back to us and help illuminate what we need. That said, so I don't necessarily spend a ton of time on reincarnation, but it definitely was a nice little, what do you call that, conceit to create this idea of two worlds. Because with Winner's Labyrinth, I'm playing with the idea that our real life, our physical real life, and then our virtual online life. And so like that was happening at the time when avatars were just becoming, so all the early sync bloggers had an avatar. You know, we had these secret hero identities, almost like it was superheroes, where in the blogging world, you had a different name. You know, it was almost like you had these different characteristics. And so we didn't know who the real people were, but we had this kind of mask. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we landed on the mask of God, was because there's this idea of greater than our ego or our spacesuits that we're tapping into, you know, that we're bigger than our bodies and bigger than our finite selves, you know, the cosmic consciousness idea. Mm-hmm. And so that's fun to play with, but that definitely creates like this duality. And it was hard. So like that was the crux. It's like, so if we're striving for cosmic consciousness, does that mean that our bodies are less important?
Right.
And if so, you know, what does that mean about life? Because on a personal level, there were all these political things that I really cared about. So like, I care about the environment. I care about diet. You know, I care about political structures. I care about poverty. I care about like my individual world where I live, but then the larger world that's reflected in our national media and like what we can do about making the world a better place for everyone. And if our online life is striving to escape that, like we're striving for this imaginary space so that we don't actually have to deal with the horror of reality, that's a problem. And so I was just trying to work through all those different issues. So Winner's Labyrinth is totally the cliche coming of age first story that any writer writes. And it's like the initiation, they're writing about the initiation because the thing is the initiation.
This escapism aspect to synchromysticism. In one sense, you are just actually probably tapping into one aspect of reality. So it's not necessarily escapism. It's getting into touch with something else. But at the same time, when taken to an extreme, yeah, we're creating this bubble so as to just pretend like nothing else is going on. And I think that we live in a culture where it's a culture of mass distraction. It's how Americans are sort of kept in this bubble and that we pretend that we're enraged and pissed off, but no one is really doing anything. The machine just keeps going and going. The war machine keeps going and going. And what can we do about it? Can we do anything? Are we even trying? And I know I have to deal with that conflict within myself because I do feel rather powerless. At the same time, I feel more empowered to make art and to do something with that. And synchronistic mysticism or anything with sync, I consider some form of avant-garde art. Some people are much more avant-garde and inaccessible than others, I would say. So it's beneficial, but right, you're always on that slippery slope of, am I just totally distracting myself to death? And should I be doing something else? Is this what I'm meant to do? So on and so forth. The concept of reincarnation, I was just reading a bit from George Gurdjieff's, one of his short biographies, and there's a quote there about reincarnation. He's like, reincarnation is a perfectly reasonable conclusion to come to based on personal experience and the evidence we've accumulated so far. But at the same time, he's like, but if you adopt that wholesale, you can use that to be like, yeah, I can be lazy in this life because I'm going to have as many as I want. It makes you devalue the body and the time you have now. Or it's like a sort of a slacker escape hatch. It's like, well, I'll be reborn again. I'll just do it again. And I don't know that. What if this is my only life, that I'm fucking myself over by pretending that I'll have all these chances, when in reality, when we're tapping into past lives, it might be just nothing else except our self-awareness can get amplified in these moments of transcendent experience, and we're just tapping into a biological reality or a self-knowledge that doesn't say anything about a soul. It just says something about the timelessness of our genetics, which might not have any intelligence to it whatsoever. So these are always tricky for me, and that's why I want to entertain all ideas and not believe anything, because if I have a belief and then that belief disappoints me, then what do I do? Where do I go from there? And then how do I lead my life? So it's extremely difficult to deal with that. And also with reincarnation, it's like, well, some people think they're tapping into information from a past life, but if the holographic universe principle has anything to it, which I think it does to some point, our minds are just open to information all the time. And we resonate with certain things, but it doesn't mean we're reincarnated. It means we're tapping into an information matrix that can give us information. That's all. So some people who say, I'm Aleister Crowley reincarnated, I'm Tesla reincarnated. Probably not. Probably not. You're probably just tapping into a piece of it. And it's interesting to see these characters pop up again and again, because they are kind of part of the more modern gestalt. So I think you see people more or less saying, I'm this person or I'm that person, because they're more contemporary. Whereas someone in 1700 would say, I'm this person reincarnated, you know?
So, like, think of it like a video game. Would you want to play the early levels again?
Right. Probably not.
Like the Tom Cruise movie, Die Another Day, or what was that movie called? The thing you don't see is that, so to learn each of the moves, he had to die, live, die, repeat.
Yeah, I saw the movie. I can't remember it.
So how tedious would that actually be? I'm not a video gamer, but the idea of joystick codes where it's up, up, back, back, four, four, you know, that's your life. To get back to the place where you need to be, you know, that's super lame. To translate that in 42 minutes, what I realize is, like, because it's a weekly show, we have this one moment to do this thing, right? And so here's the guest. They wrote this book. When that moment's over, it's over, you know? The next moment's coming, and my chance to read that book is gone because I don't have the time. That is the moment. And if I don't take advantage of it, it'll be gone. It may come again, but it's never going to come again the way it was. And so it's like, to really take advantage of the moment, it requires meeting the moment with agency, I guess is the word. Back to the idea of transcendence. So one of the things that we found early on with 42 minutes was, we're not seeking a disembodied transcendence, which is what one of the things that you kind of get from like a psychedelic trip a little bit, where it's happening in your mind on some level. And so I suppose that's one of the reasons why I kind of like Tom Campbell, where there's kind of an embodied transcendence through meditation and yoga. Even though he's talking about coming out of his body, there's still this embodied quality to it.
And there's still a relevance to the body. He's saying there's a point to this life, which is evolving your consciousness, gaining those low entropy states, and that might pay off for your astral body or something. But at the same time, he's saying that, yeah, enjoy your life. Make those small decisions. Those are the important ones. So day in, day out, that's what should matter to you. It helps you savor life more, whether you think there's a payoff or not.
Yeah. Right. And then so like that was the other thing. It's like in Winter's Labyrinth, we're not here for no reason. And then if we are, you might as well enjoy it, because when it's done, it's done. But if you're supposed to be here, then don't look for the exit. Figure out what's up.
Yeah. And I think you have to hold both those points of view, because it can be either. It really could be. You might have one chance, or this might be a continuum of experience that's, you're part of this learning system that, again, this is just one life of many. But either way, I feel like both philosophies really promote the idea of live your life to its fullest and make something of it now. Do what you can. And for me, I've settled on this sort of artistic way of life to put myself out there, to make a difference, to make myself timeless or something. Or how can I change people's minds? It's like, am I just going to go in a political forum and argue and get involved with these sorts of animal territorial bullshit? Or am I just going to try to create something as timeless or as high integrity as I can imagine from my perspective and put it out there? And if people want to enjoy it or tap into it, good. If not, I can't do anything about that.
Yeah. And so I found that I need Sync to be not a religion. It can definitely be an animating artistic inspiration. So Sync is a force that we're exploring, that we're trying to understand. It isn't a religion that we're selling. As soon as I felt like I was selling religion, that was the hardest space for me to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't do it. It made me crazy.
Well, people don't need more belief systems. They just need a way to, I don't know, interact constructively with their surroundings and their world. And I think synchronicity is like one of those, because it is so different for so many people and how they experience it. It's a very wide spectrum. And obviously all of us are doing different things with it. I'm not making Jay Kotze videos, but I'm doing something that I think is still being fueled by sync. We're all fueled by this thing. And so in that sense, it's sort of like it's like an energy in and of itself. And that's what's so interesting about it.
Well, from one standpoint, you could start a religion about gravity.
Right.
But then at some point you realize gravity is just a force of the universe and it will respond to what you do to it, but it isn't God. It might be a part of God or, you know, something that is a nature of God, but it isn't God. And so I don't think sync is God, but it's definitely an important vital force of the universe that's kind of been left out of materialistic sciences.
Yeah, in so many ways I see it as a fifth force now. But you have to start coming around to the idea that the mind is not completely in your brain, because synchronicity has this interaction with the mind and this bleed through with objective reality, that there has to be some sort of interactions in there. And so then, yeah, right, then that opens up the question of, okay, is the mind a force? Is consciousness a force? Are these two things synonymous? Are they parallel? Are they the same thing? And we don't know, and we might never know, but we're at least exploring the possibility of that. And I think that's really constructive. And I think we're always striving as humans to find a more holistic perspective on things. We're always trying to add to or unveil new pieces of reality. And I think this is really just one step on that road. And I was just reading this book, Art and Physics, where the author's thesis is basically that most of the time, not all the time, but a lot of the time, big findings in science were preceded by sort of the same aesthetic revolution going on in art or in philosophy. In this case, he's saying art. So in this sense, I see sync as sort of that, not leading the way, but giving a hint of things to come. That when our technology allows us to explore these things, if it ever does, which I have questions about. But at the same time, I do think that our analytical way of mind will eventually come around to these things in a quote-unquote objective way. And so as artists, I do kind of see us as part of that movement towards unveiling something that's always been there. And once the denialism of it ends, then it's just going to be something people take for granted in the future.
Sync. And I like to just use sync. I mean, so synchronicity is more specific than sync to me, because sync is definitely the zeitgeist. Mm. I mean, it's of its moment, where somehow that is conveying our thought process about reality. I mean, so it's just so interesting that that is part of the language that we don't even, you know, it's just there. The idea that you sync your phone, you know, you sync your various connected devices to the totality. Like there's the cloud, and you're going to sync your phone with the cloud.
Well, that's a pretty interesting distinction. I never thought about it that way, but that definitely makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah. So there's a simultaneity. And then also like meaning and connection, but then also, you know, like this shared, there's just kind of a shared, because of our internet reality now, there's this connectedness, this separate connectedness that we are experiencing. And somehow what we talk about is, you know, like the philosophical end of explaining the nature of reality. We have the language to describe what our physical selves are encountering because of our technology. But then exactly like you say, I mean, so I was thinking about that in years ago in terms of like trying to understand sync, where you have science, art, and literature all doing really strange, interesting, similar things at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's this moment, and it's almost impossible to escape your moment. You're embodying the moment, you know, in your art.
And I think we kind of talked about this in the last hangout a few nights ago, where Wally Sherrill was talking about how all these different, you go on the cutting edge of all these different areas of study, and they all seem to be converging on the same aesthetic or something. And I do feel like we're approaching one of those sorts of, I don't know, again, I don't know if I want to live to see it, but within in the context of human civilization, it's like 100, 200, 300 years, I think we can get there to being open to these sorts of new ideas in a quote-unquote scientific way, or science itself might have to be totally refashioned to accommodate sort of these new acausal principles that are at play everywhere. And so we just see them bleeding through in our life, in our subjective experience or biological life. And so it's easy just to say, well, it's all in your head. But all the forces in nature interact with biology in some fundamental way. And I think this is just the way that sync bleeds through in our life. And then you can see it out in the quote-unquote objective world, like someone like Scott Onstott. I do like his approach because, again, it's just like, hey, here are all these archaeological sites. Here's all the measurements. Through that vector, you could really see sync in a very objective way, that there's just a self-organizing quality to how important sites get laid out. And that goes so far beyond conspiracy or so far beyond statistical common sense that you're like, well, maybe there's a third thing going on here.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm always looking for, is there a cleaner way to communicate sync? Because if we're looking at, say, the Kotzian way, which is, you know, a mashup of pop media and sort of like pop media astrology, and then there's folks like Andras who use music as a medium to communicate sync. And then someone like Scott who's saying, okay, here's all these archaeological sites. And so I think there's all kinds of ways we can still kind of find sync out there and communicate it to people in a way. And that's why I like chaos theory. I know for a time you maybe were starting to get into that. And I don't know how far you went down that rabbit hole. But this idea of nonlinearity, this idea of attractors and these repeating patterns that get close to the same thing. Like you said that earlier, we seem to have these experiences of deja vu or past life that are close, or we have a feeling of closeness, but it never gets there. I mean, that's a tenet of chaos theory 101. So I do see chaos at play everywhere. And I see synchronicity as part of those dynamics. And maybe chaos is just a special case of synchronicity, but it's just interesting too, because you look in mythology or anything and chaos is the primordial substance. It's the acausal nonlinear thing that everything erupts out of. So there's these interesting parallels that I like to explore.
Was chaos developed at Santa Cruz with Ralph Abrams? Was that the crew that was doing chaos, or what were they doing there?
Yeah, they were one group. I mean, there was a lot. Again, speaking of this idea of convergence and all these disparate groups working on one thing and sort of coming towards the same aesthetic, but Ralph Abraham and the Santa Cruz group did some work on chaos dynamics. They did some stuff with like leaky faucets. They did some really ingenious stuff, but yeah, they were a core of it. But there was this guy, Mitchell Feigenbaum in New Mexico. There was Lorenz at Harvard or MIT. I'm forgetting where he was. There were a lot of characters in the story. There's a great book called Chaos by James Gleick. It was written in 87 or something, right around the time. And he catalogs all the characters, but it was really a communal effort to bring this about. So you had this convergence of this Gaia hypothesis of these ideas are finally coming to people, and we have this computer technology to finally model it. And then, bam, chaos theory blows up.
Yeah, and it seems like this is the story. It doesn't matter what the subject is. So right now I'm reading about Jack Parsons and rocketry, and there's a group of people and their characters. And what's interesting is Jack Parsons actually has this occult underpinning that is motivating him and kind of fueling him. But then at the same time, there's a real world physical scientific component where they're trying to, you know, they're worried about weights and they're worried about burning and they're worried about chemistry and they're worried about reactions and oxidation and all kinds of stuff. And so like there's these real world applications. So like that's a thought that I have every now and again. Where is the, you know, at what point does sync enter into like this real world application? When does the military come knocking on our door and say, okay, you guys got something here. This is really interesting. I like what you're doing. Here's $50,000. It's the start. You know, we'll get you a building. You can call yourself the Ghostbusters or whatever you want, but we're going to weaponize this shit.
Yeah, it's the idea of this thing that inspires people. Whatever, if and how that happens, I think that we'll be exploring the mind more and more. And then as we discover more and more about the mind, the ideas around synchronicity will become more acceptable, because as is the predominant paradigm, again, is consciousness is totally produced by electrochemical forces in your body that are totally mechanical and meaningless. And there's nothing outside yourself. And so the longer we cling to that concept, which near-death experience, certain out-of-body experiences, phenomenon in psi, even something as incredulous as hauntings, which a lot of people don't give any credence to, but if you delve into that world, you find a whole smorgasbord of really good research and good evidence for really strange stuff that seems to challenge, again, these dominant paradigms of our age. And so I love Sync in that it's just like, it really is, art is meant to challenge things. And whether we're right or wrong, at least we're challenging things and keeping that tension there. Because the more people settle into a belief system, the more likely we're to settle into totalitarianism. Or so I think. But you brought up Parsons too, and he comes up every now and then in Always Accord or something, but he was into the occult and
Crowley.
Yeah, right. OTO or
yeah.
And so again, it gets to this idea of what's the utility of these ideas, and it's like, hell, it fucking inspired this guy to create all these amazing rocketries. Or going into space, you could say it has value or it doesn't, but just the fact that these sorts of belief systems can inspire people to such ends, I mean, that's their utility right there. I'm just reading this, starting to get into this idea called pragmatism as a philosophical position, and it seems to be the antecedent to someone like Wilson, where they're like, yeah, any belief system can be judged on the effects it has in someone's life and on a societal level. So if this stuff is inspiring someone to create these amazing things, then they have high utility and they should be valued. They should not be just dismissed as meaningless. So what's the utility in your life? And I think we're all trying to find that utility and a place to fit these sorts of weird occurrences or these synchronistic events into our lives. And it's different for everybody. Jack Parsons builds rockets. We do this.
Yes, we do. A lot of it.
So you've done like over 180 episodes of 42 minutes. I guess reflecting back on that, how has it changed for you? Because originally I know it started just sort of as a, how can we promote our authors?
Well, kind of. I mean, so I should give credit to Will. So Will did this thing called the Merry Men podcast, probably back in 2009. And what he was doing was he was having conversations with the various members of the Sinkhole. And it was selfish on his part because he wanted to have these conversations. But then he also was creative enough to want to present them in an interesting way. And so that was so funny, is because when I would listen to these, I would think, you know, it's like, oh, this is really good. And then I'd think, well, I would ask that follow-up question then, or I don't know about that word if he's pronouncing that. So it's funny because he was in this forum where he seemed like the authority, I respected him as the authority, but then I wondered about the presentation. It's like, wait a minute. Archetype? I've never heard anyone say it that way. But, you know, that's the thing. And so it's like, so you need the fool to jump off the cliff and start something. And Will definitely jumped off the cliff. And so somehow he and I said, let's do the thing. And so it was just something we looked forward to every week. I definitely reached a point reflecting when it was hard, because I was going through this, I had like a crisis moment where on 42 minutes, we're promoting the work of the artist that we're talking to. But does that mean that I believe in what they're saying? Like, that was the hardest thing for me to get past. So of course we want to promote the work of the guests that we have, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I believe
right
in their work. We're not a journalist show in that I'm going to challenge them and say, I think you're wrong. I don't think this supposition is correct. This does not stand here. Our show isn't about that. Our show is a general interest show. I mean, so I don't have people on anymore that I'm not interested in. My sync practice is that I go out and I send out all these little Star Wars probes to different planets to see what sticks and what I can find and bring back to the community. Mm-hmm. And so it's all about emails. I'm constantly sending out, you know, what is interesting me right now, and can I turn that into a show? Because what happens is I book the shows about a month out, and that gives me enough time to prepare for it in a meaningful way, so that if there is a book to read or a couple books, if someone's got an audio book and a book, you know, I can do a couple that way. But if I have about a month and then I plan it so that there might be some shows where we're meeting a new synchromystic or, you know, sync artist or whatnot, I don't like calling them sync heads. I'm really trying to stay away from that word. Just because it feels like what we're doing is at such a higher value than that. But I mean, I understand the word and it has meaning and it resonates too at the same time. But as like a professional artist, it's not a hobby anymore. And synchronist sounds awfully haughty.
Yeah.
But we are the synchronists. You know, it's like something Dieter and his friends would be doing. But so as far as like where we've come as a thing, it's really interesting because, you know, it's all about what can we make happen and who will say yes and why will they say yes. And so the fact that sometimes we have the same guest pool as, you know, Terry Gross's Fresh Air or Colbert, you know, like we're getting guests. That's the thing. And so it's like, what can we do? And are they willing to take us serious?
Mm-hmm.
The biggest issue that I'm worried about right now is that, you know, we're definitely flying under the radar. And so we're not playing by the rules that a normal media agency has to play by as far as copyright goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about that what happens when we reach that point where if we did get a viral hit, where let's say we did something that was interesting to a large, large audience, what does that mean for the archive? And what does that mean, you know, like when do I start producing the shows where I don't have to worry about copyright infringement? But it's so weird because the whole idea of our artistic movement is there is no copyright. I mean, what we're doing is we're recontextualizing the media and showing how it's all connected. And if something points, if something really, really effectively points, we're going to utilize that to say what we want it to say in concert with the other things so that we're not just taking someone's piece of, you know, it's Warhol. It's all the different art movements all at the same time. There's nothing new, even though it's brand new.
Right.
We have all these different tools to recontextualize the media and say the same things. Everything points. It's just someone thinks that they own that thing. That's the lame-brained 20th century American invention, right?
Mm-hmm.
I own this.
Right.
This is mine.
Right.
And if you use it, you're going to have to pay me. So I don't know. That's where we're at.
Well, that is an interesting question. I know that's why with Pentimental I try to do stuff all from scratch. So I wouldn't necessarily bump into those issues. But again, at the same time, I've been approaching these sorts of topics from an angle where I'm not necessarily integrating much media into my work, period. And even when I'm doing music for the show, it's like, okay, well, how can I start using that as a way to give a little bit of exposure to other musical artists out there, like Guillaume or Sonic or Alex or somebody who actually produces music as a quote unquote amateur, but are super talented and have a lot to offer.
Our introduction has really kind of evolved into this part of the show where there is an element of production. So I'm taking the time to go through the guest's body of work to try and guess beforehand what the show is going to be about by quoting themselves or things of the moment that are happening. So like I'm taking different chunks of things and recontextualizing it to say what I think might happen. And that isn't always the case. And so both the intro and the outro basically is just the one line at the end, the one line that Will says, thanks so much, and whatever quote we throw in there. Usually that's kind of like a joke. But I don't know what really is going to happen in the show. I have an idea because I pitched the idea to the guest, and that's the thing. It's like, hey, guest, we want to talk about how awesome you did this. And then usually the intro and the outro speak to that, but it's kind of our way of – that's like our creative – it's the appetizer before the main course.
And what was the name of the astrologer that you had on more recently?
Benabel Wen.
I really like that show a lot because I think with these subject matters like astrology or synchronicity, they don't have a lot of cash value, so to speak, in our society. They're not taken too seriously. But you see very serious people taking them seriously and being able to speak on them in a sort of eloquent, analytical way that isn't crazy at all. It actually makes perfect sense. And astrology and chaos theory go hand in hand so well, because even the smallest effects in chaos theory can have huge amplified effects. And the solar system and the universe and the galaxy and all these things, they're all chaotic systems. So to say that minute effects could not have large effects, or small fluctuations have large effects, that happens all the time. So if you're born under a certain sign, sure, maybe that did imprint you a little bit. We already know imprint. We take imprinting. We already accept that as a reality in terms of our biological lives and our social lives. But I think with synchronicity or astrology or something, we can expand the concept of imprinting. It's like the universe imprints you, like right when you're fucking born.
It seems like I'm less worried about some of the frowned upon paranormal or occult areas. So we've done enough shows with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal that, you know, it's like the foundation is there. I don't feel like a freak, that I don't have like a normal consciousness. My safe space, my happy place is scientific materialism, reductionistic materialism. I don't need – it's okay, you know, that there are all these other weird things that we can't explain that a lot of people have done a lot of really sound work on.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so what I did find, though, after doing the Manly P. Hall thing last winter – was there are occultists that I'm not crazy about.
Hmm.
So I, you know, his work is so interesting and so fascinating, but on some level, it just did not resonate with me at all. And so I was so happy to be done, not with those shows, because those shows were fun to do, and I liked the conversations. That was the whole point. On some level, oftentimes, you know, my work is about connecting with the other people, and it's less about the material than it is about the connection.
Right.
And so the point of those shows was connecting with people that I haven't spoken with for a while, and I wanted to have a good reason to do it. And so I thought, well, you know, let's look back at one of these things that kind of started a lot of people's journeys, and I had never read it. And so I thought, well, this is something I should probably read. And then I was so happy to be done reading that, because it just was not my thing. But then someone like Peter Biebergall, his book, Occult Rock and Roll, you know, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Oh my gosh, that resonated with me. It's like, yeah. But I mean, of course, those people are looking back to people like Manly P. Hall or Crowley.
Sure. So you have to have some familiarity.
Yeah. So like there's always people that kind of beget other people. It's just our resonances change and evolve over a period of time. And things that were important aren't important later on. And yeah, it's chaos or flux or evolution or whatever. But that's one of those things. Like when I say the word evolution, I don't use that with the word progress. I don't necessarily think those are synonymous.
Yeah.
And so when you have spiritual types saying that we're evolving, there's the implication that we're getting better and that we're more advanced and that we're a higher form of whatever. And I don't know that I think of evolution in those terms.
I just see evolution as changing complexity. Those are not necessarily always good things.
I mean, I'm concerned about the future as far as the climate.
And especially as a father. I mean, you have your sons and daughters moving into the future. It's like, what world are you leaving for them? Or not you, but we as a collective.
Right. Yeah. And that was also a big part of Winter's Labyrinth is like, what kind of world are we making? You know, what am I responsible for? And what part do I play? So,
well, Douglas, we're getting pretty close to an hour. So I guess in wrapping up a bit, do you have any thing for 42 Minutes on the horizon that we should be on the lookout for? Are you working on any new novellas, any new books, any new blog posts? Or what is your vision for the near future?
Well, amazingly, I was inspired by this piece in Rolling Stone by Frances Bean. She's Kurt Cobain's daughter, and she really stated emphatically how important it is for artists to show up, to get up and just do work. And it's not like produce, it's just show up. And so like this has been – so what I'm really trying to do is cultivate a disciplined studio practice. And it's funny because 42 Minutes is kind of a part of that. And so like on show days, I do get up at 5:30 to write the copy for the show. Like I do have this But it's weird because it's connected to this thing that has so much momentum. But then as far as my own writing goes, it's harder to not procrastinate that or not, you know, goof off.
Yeah.
And so I have a book that I've been intellectualizing for a very long time now that I need to actually execute. And so I actually got up this morning and worked on it. So I'm not going to tell – I know. I probably told people. It's basically a ripoff of Philip K. Dick and The Matrix.
Okay.
Intentionally. So I want to do bad science fiction intentionally to reach a certain point in the story. And so that's the thing. I don't have any expectation of when I'd like it to be done, but I've been holding on to it for a very long time. And so now it's really time. I think I heard someone talking about how when they're building a building, oftentimes they dig around in the dirt forever. They dig and dig and dig, and you're like, Jesus, are I ever going to build that building? And then all of a sudden the building's up there. Like,
yeah.
And so I'm ready for that to happen. So on a personal level, what I'm trying to do artistically. So I have this story, and then there's a couple other pieces that I have that I would really like to get to, but I know that I have to do this one first. You know, as far as like one of the things I'm influenced by or inspired by is the beat movement, as far as, you know, our sync community goes. The beats are definitely like a big influence. And so it would be fun to do like an on the road type sync story. That's definitely basically, what do they say? You know, just a thinly disguised fiction of everything that's happened. Cause Alan's got so many great stories and, you know, all these different crosses and, you know, the story of the sync communities coming together is so fascinating to me, especially, you know, instead of New York City, it's the internet. That was like this beacon that drew us all together and we found each other. And so there's a lot of great stories that would be a shame to lose. 42 minutes. July is going to be pretty incredible. We've got Dean Radin, Nancy McGonigal, Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son. And so there's kind of like this super normal. Nancy McGonigal is the president of the Monroe Institute. And then I've got a couple maybes in there, like electronic dance music or something totally off the wall. But so, you know, July is interesting. August, we're going to take off. And then I don't know. Usually I like to come back to like a really, really strong school year, because it seems like on some level as parents, that's when the new year begins, really. It's when the kids go back to school after summer and then the new season of TV begins and all that silliness. But so we'll see. I've got some lots of interesting ideas. Oh, and then we probably need to talk about like the big thing for 2016 for me, now that we're like that far ahead, will be the idea of the 2016 Sync Summit and whether or not we create enough density and interest to see what we can manifest. So I might as well just share that. So the thought is, in Boise, Idaho, there is this Treefort Music Fest that happens every year. And I think this year was the fourth Treefort or the third. I don't know. It's hard because after a few, you start losing track. But they're the same time every year. And let me just find the dates just for the hell of it. So Treefort 323, March 23rd, 2016 through the 27th. It happens on Easter weekend, so it's Treester Fort. The idea is to do a sync summit in concert with that so we can capitalize on some of the density. There are enough people on the West Coast, and Boise is not that far. You know, we did a sync summit here, or a sync cabin here, and, you know, Steve Wilner traveled in, David Plate traveled in, Alan traveled in, Michael Schacht flew in. This is the question, you know, what do people want out of a get together? And so what, I mean, people definitely want to share space together. Do they want to be entertained, or do they want to hang out, or do they want a little of both? And, you know, Andras, his Radio 8 Ball is so great at conveying what we do to an audience, a larger audience. And so that's one of those things that we should capitalize on. If we're trying to sell our work, our art, to people, it seems like our audience our niche audience gets it and they buy our stuff and they're into our stuff. But like selling that to a larger audience that's curious, it's like, how do you break through? How do you get that out there in a way that's not like soul sucking or soul selling? And so this is one of those ideas that if we capitalize on all these different elements, because it's not just a music festival, there's a literary component, there's a film fest, there's a technology portion of the fest. And so I've got a meeting with the festival director, and we're just going to see what we can put together for that weekend, March 23rd through the 27th. And we're going to, you know, we're going to bring some sync people to town as headliners, and we're going to have some presentations, and we're going to have a good time, hang out in Boise, Idaho. So that's what's happening here. It's going to be a lot of work, but I'm looking forward to it.
So, Doug, thanks for making some time.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.